What really should be the immediate things that come to mind in this patient?
You need to have a high index of suspicion for this.
We really want to be close to the patient and listen.
That can create a lot of problems when you're trying to put that tracheostomy tube back in place.
So we're talking about action.
This is the most feared complication.
That's a veteran move, not a rookie move.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. And welcome to the first podcast here in March of 2019. Hard to believe it is already March, but we are so excited. By the time you're listening to this podcast, it's likely that you have downloaded the podcast or you're listening to it on our new website, www.criticalcareinem.com. As you can see, we've had a lot of enhancements to our website, a lot of user functionality. Very easy for you to now download those episodes onto your mobile device. You can listen to them there on the website itself. Links to our PDF of the show notes. In addition, for those of you that have the CME version, you're able to click on that link and it takes you right to your CME post-test within the Schumacher group. Lots more functionality. We think it's a great experience for you. Please let us know your feedback on our new website. We will continue to iterate this all throughout 2019, but so excited to launch our new site, and thanks for listening to our podcast. For this month, we're going to talk about an important topic worth discussing in terms of critical care, resuscitation, and, well, we see it quite frequently in the emergency department, of patients coming in with tracheostomies, but when they come in with respiratory distress, when they look bad, when they look critically ill, what are the things we need to immediately think about? What are some things we can immediately do? And then with respect to those emergencies, we'll do a little bit deeper dive into specific ones we can't miss when these patients come to us in the emergency department or they decompensate in the ICU. But as always, before we get started, let me bring in my stellar and outstanding co-host, Dr. Peter W., Dr. Robert Rodriguez, and Dr. John Greenwood. Gentlemen, how are you here in March of 2019?
Hey, guys. This is great. Wonderful time to be in New Orleans. We're in the middle of carnival season, so Mardi Gras right around the bend. So it's going to be next Tuesday. We're pretty excited.
Unbelievable. As we were chatting before we get started, Peter, something's always going on in New Orleans.
Nearly. This kicks off our festival season. And so for 50 square miles around New Orleans, this weekend till November, every weekend there's a festival. So it's great for culture, music, and food.
Always good to visit New Orleans. Well, Rob, how are things out in California?
Yeah, on the West Coast, we're celebrating torrents of rain. We're being inundated with showers, which I guess we need here in California, but everything's going well.
Outstanding. And John, Philadelphia.
Well, we're in a little stretch here in Philadelphia where we're trying to wait on this whole Bryce Harper situation that, or is he going to sign with Philadelphia or who? We don't know. So our city's up in arms right now. But every other standpoint, Philadelphia is doing just fine.
All right. Well, thanks, gentlemen. We are going to tackle our education for this month. And really what got us started thinking about this, what got me started thinking about troubleshooting the tracheostomy is a patient that came into the ED, our ED at University of Maryland, about 3 weeks ago. Was working a clinical shift and actually just happened to walk out of another patient's room when one of our triage nurses came running out, stating that a patient with a trach had shown up at the front door and accidentally had decannulated themselves. They were complaining of shortness of breath, and quite honestly, our front-end staff was a little panicky as this patient was tachypneic and looking a little uncomfortable. So really, that got us thinking, we haven't talked about this topic, I think, in actually a few years here on CCPEM. And as luck would have it, there is an outstanding article that was just published in the Journal of Emergency Medicine. Really hard to pronounce the lead author's name, but Susan Wilcox, an EM critical care intensivist, outstanding guru. She's the senior author on that paper, entitled Respiratory Distress in a Patient with a Tracheostomy. Once again, appearing in the Journal of Emergency Medicine here early in 2019. And it's really a case report of a patient that presented to their emergency department in respiratory distress, but they really do an outstanding job talking about things such as the initial management of these patients, things to consider, things to go about troubleshooting. And that's really going to serve as the basis for our discussion. So, Rob, let me turn to you. A patient comes in. Let's just say it's that patient who came into my ED 3 weeks ago. Respiratory distress. He's got a tracheostomy. They're complaining of shortness of breath, using accessory muscles, tachypneic. What really should be the immediate things that come to mind in this patient?
Yeah, Mike. So you want to consider the mnemonic DOPES, D-O-P-E-S, to help create a differential for respiratory distress in these patients. And the D in DOPES is for dislodgement or displacement of the trach itself. And D is also for deflation of the cuff in the tracheostomy. O is for obstruction of the tube with mucus or blood. And this can be a very common problem in patients with tracheostomy. P is for a number of problems, including pneumothorax. The P is silent in that, of course. Pulmonary embolism and pulmonary edema, which again can strike these patients. E is for equipment failure, which includes issues with the ventilator tubing, with connections and the power source of the ventilator and the circuit of the ventilator. And then S, remember, is for stacking, and breath stacking can be a problem with these patients. A lot of these patients may have had COPD or other issues that can make them susceptible to breath stacking. So you need to consider that in these patients.
I like that mnemonic. I think it's something that we've learned in terms of patients presenting in distress or developing distress when they have an ET tube and they're on the ventilator, but this is equally applicable to the patient who has a tracheostomy. I learned dislodgement. Rob, you added a nice pearl that it's actually D stands for deflation of the cuff as well. And for P, you expanded that differential a little bit to include PE and pulmonary edema. So a few things that I hadn't been taught with that DOPES mnemonic. So that kind of sets the stage. They're coming in. These are some immediate things to think about with problems with the tracheostomy. Peter, let me ask you, we're thinking about the DOPES mnemonic. These things are in our head. Now we've actually got to act to reverse that respiratory distress to treat the patient. What are some things we want to think about to troubleshoot that problem or to treat the patient?
Right. So we're talking about action. And so there's a great mnemonic for this called DOTS, D-O-T-T-S. And that really helps us troubleshoot in a priority sense. Because I think first and foremost, that D should be removing the patient from the ventilator and removing the ventilator from the entire troubleshooting equation. You already heard earlier from Rob that there's a number of things that the ventilator can do that can trigger the patient. And as we remove the patient from the ventilator, we really want to be close to the patient and listen. Because if we hear a hissing sound or a wheezing noise that's all exhalatory, we want to really think that this has been breath stacking caused by the machine or caused by inherent bronchospasm. That's important. If you think that's this continued exhalatory wheeze going on, you might want to use one or two sets of hands to compress the thorax to kind of promote emptying of a hyperinflated lung. And we've done that a number of times with vented patients, whether they be trached patients or even those patients with standard endotracheal tubes. So D is for disconnect from the ventilator. O is for providing oxygen. And we can't underestimate in patients who are in respiratory distress to add supplemental oxygen. So this is bag valve mask with a PEEP valve that may be needed for these patients. If you find that bagging the patient is really difficult, and this is one of the things that I don't think you should hand that bag valve mask over to the respiratory therapist or a student or a resident, I think that the tactile information you get from squeezing the bag is critically important. And so as you go to squeeze the bag and you can't squeeze it, you're now thinking immediately that this is an obstruction. So you really need to think what we need to do when the lungs are not compliant. It could also be too much pulmonary edema or fluid or hemorrhage or even pneumothorax in these patients. If in fact it's a complete opposite and you squeeze the bag and it's easy peasy to squeeze, there's zero resistance, you need to think that there may be a profound air leak, a deflated cuff, or even complete tube dislodgement. And so that tactile information from you squeezing the bag is invaluable, and that's a veteran move, not a rookie move. That's a veteran move. You want someone who knows how to judge how that bag should feel to be bagging. And so that's the D and the O. The first T is for tube positioning. And again, you want to check the tube depth in relation to the prior recordings of that tracheostomy tube. Ideally, you'd like to pass something innocuous like a suction catheter, again, to make sure that it's not obstructed and that you can pass that all the way through. If the tube is obstructed and you can't clear it with suctioning, you want to consider deflating the cuff so that the patient can breathe around that cuff. And that's a big ticket item to remember. I think that's a good, strong pearl. If the patient's still unable to breathe after suctioning and deflating the cuff, you're going to need to think about replacing that tube. And so let me just give a shout out to John and say, John, in your house, right, in your ED, in your critical care world, what do you think would be the ideal equipment to have at the bedside in these kind of cases?
That's a great question, Peter. And this is one of those circumstances where you want to be prepared for anything. I grab an airway box, and our airway boxes are stocked with endotracheal tubes as well as tools for intubation. I think you want to be prepared for, as you mentioned, if you have to and you can't get the tracheostomy tube replaced, well, maybe intubating from above. And I think that intubating from above is something that can be stressful for someone with a tracheostomy, but we'll talk about types in just a second. The only thing you want to consider is just making sure that this isn't a laryngectomy patient, because these head and neck cancer patients, if they've had a laryngectomy, you actually can't intubate them from above. But fortunately, it's usually a lot easier to replace the laryngectomy tubes in these types of patients. But getting back to changing a tracheostomy, things I'm doing within the first minute of a patient walking through the door is I'm looking at that tracheostomy tube, and on the lateral flanges of that trach, there's a lot of really valuable information. So some of the important things to look for are going to be the make and the model of the tracheostomy. So the most common tracheostomies, at least the ones we use in our hospital and down at University of Maryland when I was a trainee, was the Shiley trachs. And on them, there's nicely imprinted on the side the inner diameter of the tracheostomy, but more importantly, the outer diameter. And so, for example, and I've no ties to any of these companies, but a Shiley 6-0, for example, that would mean that the outer diameter is estimated around 6 millimeters. Now, with the cuff, that's probably a little bit more, but it gives you a sense of what size the tracheostomy is that you're going to need to replace. And so once I have that information of the size and make of the tracheostomy, I can ask someone to go grab me the same size, and then you're going to want to have one size smaller, because over time, these tracheostomy holes, depending on how long they've been there, can shrink pretty rapidly if that tracheostomy is out already. So you want to give yourself a backup and have a smaller size, like a 4 if there's a 6 in there already, for example. So looking for the size as well as the dimensions are going to be important. Every now and then, you'll get a strange tracheostomy tube. So there's some variations of these that it's worth knowing. One of them being an XLT. And oftentimes what that means is that one of the dimensions, whether it's the anterior posterior distance or the length of the tracheostomy tube, is a little bit longer. And these are used for patients who have a little bit of different anatomy. So if they have a big, thick neck, they might have a longer tracheostomy in the AP distance. Or if they have some sort of airway anatomy issue that they need a longer tracheostomy, that might be noted on the tracheostomy flange itself. And in those cases, I'm probably not going to be able to get a replacement quickly. I'm just going to use an endotracheal tube or something else as a temporizing way to establish an airway. Now, I've got the size, I've got the make, I've got the model. The next thing I'm looking for is whether or not, this may sound simple, but a pilot balloon. So some tracheostomies, as they get downsized, they don't have cuffs anymore. And that's to allow patients to speak and to eat and do other things easily. If there's no pilot balloon, I'm going to have to change that out to one with a cuff if I plan on putting them on a ventilator. Oftentimes, that cuff adds a lot of width to the trach, so I'm going to go a size smaller than the one that's currently there so that I make sure that that tracheostomy tube with a cuff fits nicely so I can bag the patient, particularly if they're hypoxic or in respiratory distress. Now, we've got our equipment. So fortunately, we've had someone bring back a size equal to and smaller of that tracheostomy tube. Now we have to make the exchange. And there's a number of ways you can do that. But to keep it simple, I usually recommend doing a basic Seldinger technique using either a bougie, or if you don't have a bougie available, you can get a simple OG tube and cut off the side port and use that as a semi-rigid stylet so that you're not inserting the tracheostomy tube blindly. And this is critical because that guide wire or guide tubing, if it's a tube or a bougie, will prevent you from reinserting this into a false passage. And when I'm reinserting, I'm doing something that's very important. We talk about this in airway all the time, is patient positioning. Well, when we're intubating someone, we talk about ear to sternal notch or ear to sternum all the time in terms of the head positioning. The difference with tracheostomies is it's important to remember, and some of us probably haven't been in the OR in a while, but when tracheostomies are inserted, the patient's head is often in extension. And so when you're reinserting that tracheostomy tube, you want them flat in a bed and head in extension so that that tracheostomy hole lines up nicely with the trachea underneath. If they're in flexion or neutral position, sometimes some soft tissue can hang down in front of the tracheostomy track, and that can create a lot of problems when you're trying to put that tracheostomy tube back in place. So those are some of the things that I'm thinking about, specifically about replacing the tube.
That was simply outstanding, John. Peter or Rob, do you have anything to add to what John was saying?
No, I'm in full agreement with that. And again, I can't stress enough the importance of a bougie for these cases. I find that incredibly helpful at the bedside, just for replacements as well as managing any kind of surgical airway.
Yeah, I completely agree. That was a great summary of what to do for that scenario. The bougie, again, is going to be your device of choice, and you really got to maintain that position that John mentioned as well.
Well, Peter, I think we still have one more T to go in your DOTS mnemonic.
So again, we said the DOTS were disconnect, get your oxygen ready to go. The first one was tube positioning. And the next one is really tweaking the ventilator. And this would probably be most important if the patient's breath stacking or unable to get rid of volume and pressure. And so when those are the cases, like acute asthma patients with profound bronchospasm, the pearls here to reduce the respiratory rate, and that would be somewhere around the lines of 8 to 12 breaths per minute, and then reduce the tidal volume as well. And that tidal volume may be 6 cc's per kilogram, so a smaller tidal volume. So just, again, those are the number one steps in somebody that we're trying to address I to E ratio and have more time for exhalation.
All right, so we've covered a few important things and talked about a ton of pearls in that initial management of patients with a trach presenting in respiratory distress. Now, that could be the patient you receive and transfer from a skilled nursing facility. When they're on the ventilator, it could be patients coming in off the ventilator and still having a tracheostomy. Let's kind of delve into the second half of the podcast and just talk about a few select tracheostomy emergencies that you may encounter in the ED or in the ICU. And a lot of these complications, a lot of these emergencies tend to be grouped by the time the trach was placed. Usually that's around 7 days or so when the tracheal stoma matures. So there's a few conditions to think about within that first week. There's a few to think about after the first week of placement. We'll go through those relatively quickly. If you happen to be, say, at the bedside and you're participating, let's just say, in a percutaneous trach, and there's bleeding or hemorrhage during the insertion or right after the initial insertion of the trach, the two primary things to consider: posterior wall lacerations and then creation of a false track or paratracheal insertion of the tracheostomy tube. Now, in those first 7 days, you know, usually the patient's hospitalized, so this is more applicable per se to the inpatient setting. John, what are the important things to consider? What tracheal emergencies occur within the first week following placement?
So the first week is a very tenuous time if the tracheostomy comes out. And oftentimes this is because that tracheostomy stoma can retract really, really quickly if it's not replaced. And oftentimes, if this comes dislodged, we're just intubating from above and starting all over again, rather than trying to stuff in a new trach, unless it can be done relatively quickly. Now, at University of Pennsylvania, we've actually had some early tracheostomies become dislodged because our CT scanner that's often used by our inpatient floors is right next to our ED. So we've had one or two during patient movements where these trachs have fallen out while the nurses are moving them from bed to scanner. So it is worth knowing, particularly if your environment get something similar to ours. So the first thing, and sometimes people don't even know how long the tracheostomy's been there. Some clues that might lead you to believe, oh, wow, this is fresh, is if you see that the suture ties are actually still in the tracheostomy flanges, those are usually there for about a week. And so if those pulled through the skin and you see sutures dangling from your tracheostomy, that's a fresh one. So the things that I'm looking for, particularly and worried about in the first 7 days, are certainly bleeding from the tracheostomy stoma itself. So there's thyroid vessels, thyroid veins, there's external jugular veins that sometimes can get in the way, or a bunch of other things that can cause some bleeding from the tracheostomy site itself. Stoma infection. So I'm really taking a close look at the stoma. If there's a patient with respiratory distress, is there any signs of new cellulitis or even worse, signs of mediastinitis? Cannulation can happen, and you have to be ready and prepared for that. Looking for other signs of not just maybe decannulation, but displacement, you can see signs of subcutaneous emphysema in the chest and the shoulders, and it's like a spongy sensation. My kids play with this, like, it's kind of foamy Play-Doh. If you press on it, it's kind of crunchy. It feels like Rice Krispies. That can be a sign that the tracheostomy is actually partially or fully dislodged and in a false track. Definitely worried about aspiration, and certainly pneumothorax can occur, particularly in patients with chronic lung disease who are at risk for pneumothorax at baseline. These patients who are vent dependent are at risk for pneumothorax, so always in the back of my head.
Outstanding. Well, let's transition now to things that occur after the first 7 days. So usually the tracheostomy stoma has had time to mature. And I think everybody's thinking, well, this is going to be our tracheoarterial fistula, probably a tracheoanominant fistula. But there's actually a few things in addition to that we should consider. Peter, what are those entities?
Well, remember, we're talking about 7+ days. And at this time, typically, the tracheal stoma is mature. Now, the only patients that I get concerned about are those patients with elevated BMI that have a little bit more tissue, and that tract can still be a little bit tenuous at 7 days. But the things that we think about are, first and foremost, tracheal stenosis. Again, this is most commonly a long-term complication, not immediately at 7 days. It can occur above, below, or actually at the level of the stoma. It's usually due to the formation of proud flesh or granulation tissue from inflammation or infection, or it can be a combination of the two. It tends to typically present between 1 and 6 months. So again, you want to think about that time course for issues for tracheal stenosis, 1 to 6 months. And then the treatment for this is either going to be abject surgery, some people use laser therapy, and then you can also have tracheal dilation of these patients. So that's, again, tracheal stenosis. And you compare and contrast that with tracheal malacia. And so with tracheal malacia, the pathophysiology is quite similar to tracheal stenosis, but the anatomy is a little bit wonkier. In tracheal malacia, the cartilage is kind of kaflooey. It gets weakened and then gets destroyed. So it's no longer functional. And so what happens is the airway typically collapse during exhalation. So imagine, you know, trap volume, trap pressure, and you go to breathe out and the tracheal walls are touching each other. The definitive management here may require either stenting of the airway, or actually they'll resect part of the trachea if it's a small enough area of tracheal malacia. The short-term solution for us as practitioners managing this difficult airway patient is simply using a longer tube. So if you don't have the XL tube handy, you can go ahead and use an endotracheal tube. So the XL tube is there. There's also a tube called the Bavona that can occupy a lot of space in tracheal malacia. But when you don't have those handy, you can just use an endotracheal tube, but deeper. There is some other things, just a couple other things to mention, is just delayed stomal closure. We can see that, and some usually associated with infection for that. And then vocal cord paralysis we can see as well, and that can complicate matters.
Outstanding. Well, those are important. And actually, I was surprised to hear that actually it's tracheal stenosis that's the most common long-term complication, Peter. I think we're all thinking about that tracheoarterial fistula, but you've gone over some important, more common things to consider when patients come in after that first 7 days of placement. Well, Rob, let's turn things over to you. Bring us home. Bring the podcast to a close. You're talking about probably the most feared and dreaded complication or emergency with a tracheostomy, and that's the tracheoarterial fistula.
Yeah, Mike, indeed. This is the most feared complication, which is tracheoarterial fistula. This has an estimated mortality of about 80%. So it's a highly lethal, big problem when it occurs. And this usually occurs within the first 3 weeks of tracheostomy placement, but it really can occur at any time. And so you do need to watch out for it at any time patient notes bleeding from the tracheostomy. And this typically presents with brisk bleeding, but beyond brisk bleeding, it's important to note that about 50% of patients who have a tracheoarterial fistula will present initially with a small sentinel bleed, which is basically a self-limited bleed that stops by the time the patient gets to the ER or presents for evaluation. So you need to have a high index of suspicion for this or sentinel bleed occurring and note that and report that if you have a patient presenting that way. But in terms of the true emergent tracheoarterial fistula bleed, this is going to be brisk bleeding, and it really results from erosion into the anterior tracheal wall into the vessel. And the most common location of the fistula is going to be the innominate artery, followed by the aortic arch, and also the right common carotid. Notably, all of these are big vessels, so they can bleed a lot, and it can be, you know, really a disastrous situation. In terms of dealing with this, it's going to be a high rectal tone situation. So you're really going to want to get all capable hands on deck, including your anesthesiologist, anesthesia and surgical colleagues. And if you suspect a fistula bleed, the first step is to overinflate the cuff to tamponade the bleeding against the wall. And if this doesn't work, what you need to do is you need to remove the tracheostomy and manually compress the artery against the posterior sternum with your finger in the stoma. And again, this is going to be a very high intensity situation, high mortality. So you're going to really want a lot of people there to help you, because while you're trying to stop the bleeding, you're still going to have to maintain ventilation and resuscitate the patient. So again, this is the most feared complication. You really do need to have a high index of suspicion. If any patient reports a brisk bleeding episode, you need to make sure that this is not a sentinel event. And when it does truly occur in front of you, you really got to act fast and use a team approach to deal with it.
Very, very helpful, Rob. Guys, this has been an extremely useful podcast filled with pearls, a few pitfalls, but really, really nice job in going through the approach to a patient who comes in, has a tracheostomy, and they present to one of our varied settings in some degree of distress, things to think about immediately, things to do and act on immediately, and then just longer term thinking about those complications and emergencies, the etiologies that we're likely to see when these patients come in either to the ED or get admitted to the ICU. Well, I think that's going to wrap it up for this particular podcast here, our first in March of 2019. Our thanks once again for listening to CCPEM. Once again, let us know what you think of the new and improved, the streamlined website. We're so excited to have it launched. We're so excited to have you listening to our podcast. Love to hear the feedback. If you have any questions on this specific episode, let us know through the website. Our congrats to Drs. Prisbelow, Dr. Whittles, and Dr. Wilcox on an outstanding article in the Journal of Emergency Medicine on a tough case they had on a patient who presented with a tracheostomy emergency. You can find that once again in the Journal of Emergency Medicine. We'll put a link to that in our handout for the episode, and that's going to do it, I think. This is Mike Winters once again for CCPEM from University of Maryland School of Medicine in Baltimore. Looking forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.